All right, cool. Well, so good evening, world, or good morning, world. This is really, really amazing. It's something I've been very, very excited about for a while, is teaching a Mises Academy course, because this really, I think, could very well be the future of higher education. We have people so far from, we have Danny Sanchez, who's moderating this from Taiwan. I am in my office in Memphis. We have three people who have checked in from Westport, Connecticut, Prague, Czech Republic, and Montreal, Canada. So this is the first of five meetings in which we're going to talk about capitalism and socialism, and quite honestly, just about everything in between. This is the first lecture on capitalism, socialism, and the mixed economy. And what I'm probably going to do is after each lecture, I'll add a quiz based on the lecture, and then another quiz based on the readings for the lecture leading up, or for the readings for the next lecture, then another quiz after the following lecture, and so on and so forth. But before we get going, I wanted to say a very quick word or two about sort of what inspired me to choose this topic, why capitalism and socialism? Because if you're familiar at all with the Austrian tradition, you know that economics has basically wiped out the case for socialism based on the idea that socialism is a more rational form of economic organization. But nonetheless, a political philosopher named G.A. Cohen wrote a book and published a book that gained some notoriety called Why Not Socialism just within the last few years. So what I wanted to do is take a few weeks to explore exactly what it is about capitalism and what it is about socialism and what it is about everything in between that makes certain social systems popular or feasible or practicable. So with that, this is also a contribution to a couple of very, very long-run goals. I studied with Douglas North at Washington University in St. Louis, and in November, we celebrated his 90th birthday. And in 2009, he and a couple of co-authors published a book called Violence and Social Order. Basically, what it was a framework for interpreting recorded human history. What I want to do by the time I've turned 90 is I want to have written a book called, and this is a quote actually from Keynes, it's intentional, it's called The Possibility of Civilization. So part of this is going to be the beginning of an exploration that I'm hoping is going to last the rest of my life on the kinds of social institutions that make for not just a well-functioning civilization or even a flourishing civilization, but even a possible civilization. So big, important question. Which set of social institutions is not just desirable, but which sets of social institutions are practicable? So here's a very brief outline of where we're going to go. We're going to talk a little bit about concepts and definitions. We're going to talk about specific economic systems, capitalist systems, interventionist systems, and socialist systems. We'll talk about the criticism of capitalism. We'll consider an example of economic calculation in the tradition of Mises' classic article that we're going to talk about next week. We'll talk about what that implies about social organization. We'll consider a couple of the objections that people have raised to the capitalist order. And then finally, we'll conclude and evaluate. So I chose Hans Hermann Hoppe's book, A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism, as one of the core texts. The first time I read this book was 2 years ago, the first time I taught a course called Classical and Marxian Political Economy here at Rhodes, and I was really taken with just how clear the book is and with how simple the logic is that it presents as it discusses the institutions of socialism and the institutions of capitalism. What we're going to concern ourselves with for about the next month and a half is, to quote Hoppe, the central problems of political economy and political philosophy. Continuing to quote from Hoppe, these problems are how to organize society so as to promote the production of wealth and eradicate poverty, and how to arrange it so as to make it a just social order. So fundamentally, we're asking questions about how to organize society, how to get a society that produces wealth, how to get a society that eradicates poverty, and then from a philosophical and moral perspective, how to get a society that embodies a just social order. There are a couple of different ways we can do this. We can consider a handful of different economic systems, a handful of different possibilities. One is capitalism. I'm not a big fan of capitalism. I think capitalism is great and wonderful and fantastic. Capitalism fundamentally rests on private ownership of the means of production. So not just private ownership of consumption goods, but private ownership of production goods as well. So private ownership of the means of production and voluntary exchange of property titles. So specifically, we have private property and voluntary trade. We have voluntary interaction where people are able to induce us to cooperate with them by offering to expand our set of possibilities. The opposite extreme is socialism. Socialism is a system of social organization based not on private ownership of the means of production and not on voluntary trade, but on common ownership of the means of production and, by necessity, centralized and involuntary cooperation, usually induced by the directives of a central planning board or something to that effect. So on one end, we have private property traded voluntarily. On the other end, we have common property not traded but allocated involuntarily by a central planning board. Some combination of the two, and this is what's going to characterize most societies that we actually observe in the world, is interventionism. It's some mix of private ownership of the means of production and common ownership of the means of production. It's some mix of voluntary exchange of private property titles and involuntary allocation of not common property titles necessarily, but just involuntary allocation of social resources owned by society, whatever that happens to mean, or under the control of directives of some kind of central planning bureau. So what we actually observe in the world is some kind of mix between capitalist and socialist institutions. So you should notice here, there's a problem with socialism right off the bat, and that is what exactly constitutes the means of production. It's obvious what a consumption good is. So, for example, I have here a glass of water. Well, not really a glass of water, a styrofoam cup of water. This is a consumption good. There were means that went into the production of this, but it's pretty obvious that this is a consumption good. I do a lot of writing, and I have here a pen. This pen is owned by Rhodes College, my employer, and here's a different pen that's owned by me. So are these means of production? This is not necessarily an attempt to be pedantic about this. Rather, this is a question that socialism itself can't answer. You know, if we're going to define means of production in a meaningful sense, then we have to say that this has to be commonly owned. This has to be commonly owned. This has to be commonly owned. This perhaps might be privately owned, but all of these, anything that we might call a higher order good, i.e. something that goes into the production of a consumption good, is going to be considered means of production and therefore subject in some sense to social ownership. It's not clear to me necessarily where and how we draw the line in any meaningful sense between common ownership and private ownership, or where we draw the line between a consumption good and the means of production. Well, let's just go ahead and assume that the socialists can solve that problem and proceed by considering, again, a handful of important ideas and important concepts. The first is property. So Hoppe argues that the existence of scarcity necessitates property. And even in a situation like the Garden of Eden, where everything is super abundant, we nonetheless have to have, in some sense, private property over our persons and private property over our standing room. Private property is the extension of our being into the material world around us, and according to the communists, according to the socialists, it's also the source of all of our troubles. In the Communist Manifesto and elsewhere, Marx and his co-author Friedrich Engels argue for the abolition of private property as being the essence of the socialist program, or as being the essence of the communist program, and as being ultimately the revolutionary fruits that will produce material superabundance and universal brotherhood and, in a very real sense, the new millennium, albeit an atheized new millennium, but nonetheless the next stage in the evolution of humanity. When we talk about something being private property, we mean that it has a couple of different characteristics. The essence of private property is the right to exclude others from using something. It's the right to prevent others from exercising their will over our persons or over the material stuff that constitutes our private property. It also includes our ability to choose how to use things. A set of property rights defined by a state in some cases, or defined by society at large, is a set of rules that define who owns what and the circumstances under which they're owned. A strong set of private property rules is going to be necessary for the kind of prosperity that we enjoy today. I'm going to digress for just a second here because periodically I see a lot of articles that come into my field of vision where people are writing about how we're alienated and demoralized by this piece of technology or that piece of technology or what other piece of technology, and that we're no longer sharing our species essence or species being with other people who might happen to share our interests. I always find this a little bit funny and tragic because people say, "Oh yeah, the iPhone makes us alienated and demoralized. The Apple products make us alienated and demoralized." Never mind the fact that we literally have people from all parts of the globe who right now are for 90 minutes getting together to talk about capitalism and socialism. Somehow, you know, this makes us alienated and demoralized. Not exactly sure of the degree to which I take that criticism seriously. If you have any questions about it, feel free to email me. But we'll talk about it a little bit at the end of the lecture tonight, and then in a few weeks, we'll talk more directly about cultural criticisms of capitalism. The next idea is the concept of contract. A contract, according to Hoppe, is an agreement about the voluntary use of private property. We contract with one another to exchange titles to private property. You trade title to your car for money, or for essentially ownership of money from somebody. And one of the really cool things about this is the engine of wealth creation. Trade creates wealth. That's one of the central propositions in all of economics. And specifically, it's the ability to contract and thereby exchange private property that enables us to create wealth. Wealth creation takes place in two different senses. In the first, you take something you don't want, and you trade it to someone for something that you do want. They get something they prefer to what they give up. You get something you prefer to what you give up. You're both better off. In that sense, trade is creating wealth. Trade also allows us to exploit our comparative advantages, to produce that for which we have the lowest opportunity cost. And one of the neat things about contract and the neat things about trade is that the more people can trade, the more people can exchange, the more opportunities they have to trade, the prices of the things that they're buying will fall, while the prices of the things that they're selling will rise. And this, I think, is really, really cool. Even though, two parties might enter into an exchange, for both sellers, they're getting more in exchange for what they're giving up. As buyers, they're each getting more in exchange for what they're giving up. They're both literally better off, and this, in a sense, is kind of the miracle of the marketplace. Contract is necessary for trade. Trade is necessary for the creation of wealth, and the abrogation of contract, specifically aggression against private property rights and aggressive interference with the right of contract, produces, unfortunately, the kind of poverty that we see around the world today. So let's think about what it means to aggress against someone's private property rights. Again, borrowing from Hoppe, aggression is uninvited interference with and change in the physical integrity of another's private property. So you can do two things. First, you can just absolutely abscond with someone else's stuff. You can steal from them. You can take their physical private property, or you can prevent them from making trades that you find unacceptable. Aggression creates no wealth. When people have incentives to produce and exchange, when they have incentives to enter into contracts to trade, then we get wealth. When they have incentives to expropriate and redistribute, when they have incentives to be aggressive, then we get poverty. So fundamentally, there are two different ways to get people to cooperate with you. You can either contract with them. You can try to persuade them. You get them to do things that you want them to do by offering to expand their options and make their lives better. Or you can aggress against them. You can coerce them. You can get them to do the things that you want them to do by threatening to limit their options or by threatening violence against them. As we've seen, it's freedom of contract that has produced, by and large, the kind of wealth that we enjoy in the Western world. Be that as it may, there have been a lot of people who have had serious criticisms of capitalism as a social system and serious criticisms of exchange as a mechanism by which people can cooperate. Specifically, the socialists, largely of the 19th century and indeed of the 20th century, argued that capitalism had a number of fundamental flaws. First, voluntary capitalism is necessarily irrational. It causes us to waste resources, and it causes us to grope about in the dark trying to find an optimal allocation of resources, which is almost certainly going to be clearly inferior to what the best minds of the world could produce. So, for example, one debate that we're having in Memphis right now is about whether an old and now empty church building should be razed in order to put up a drugstore. There are already two drugstores on that corner, and people are saying, well, do we not have enough drugstores already? You know, why do we need more competition? Why couldn't we just have one drugstore that sells all of the stuff, and then we would have two street corners we could use for other means? This is clearly irrational capitalism. When I think it was, if I remember correctly, Charles Walgreen, when he first opened Walgreens, Someone said to him, don't you think that this city has enough drugstores? And he said, well, maybe, but they don't have enough Walgreens drugstores. I look at this as a defender of capitalism and as a student of entrepreneurship, and I say, well, this is a great thing, you know, that we have freedom of entry, freedom of experimentation and whatnot. The critics of capitalism looked at this and said, well, what we have here is incredible waste of resources because why should Walgreens open more drugstores? Don't we have enough? Maybe we could expand some, but then we wouldn't need all of this wasteful competition when all these resources could be better used elsewhere. Another criticism of capitalism is that it's prone to cycles. It's prone to crises of overproduction. So it's prone to these situations in which we produce too much stuff. We produce more output than can be absorbed by demand. And this throws everything out of whack. It causes massive unemployment. It causes massive misallocation. It causes massive relocation and unnecessary poverty and unnecessary stress that could be avoided if we simply put the planning of the economic system in the hands of the experts. Finally, the critics of capitalism argue that it's a system that's fundamentally unjust. You've probably heard someone use the phrase, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. It was argued by many of the critics of capitalism that that's exactly what happened. The owners of the satanic mills were the ones who got richer and richer and richer and richer, and they did this, as Marx would later explain, by extracting surplus value from the hides of their workers. This doesn't necessarily rely on any ill intent on the part of the capitalists, but rather, according to Marx, this occurred because of the nature of the capitalist system itself. The nature of the capitalist system was the production and appropriation of surplus value by rich capitalists. We get a progression as we move through the late 18th century into the early 19th century of classical and then Marxian views of the economic system. According to Adam Smith, voluntary exchange led to the enjoyment of a mutual harmony of interests that led to what he called the natural progress of opulence. Free trade and voluntary exchange led to overall economic progress. David Ricardo would later be very sympathetic to the set of views, but he focused most of his attention on the distribution of factor payments, specifically payments to landowners, which would absorb all of the income, payments to capitalists, and then payments to laborers, who would tend toward subsistence. Ricardo would himself focus primarily on distribution and on the class conflicts that were generated by an unequal and in some cases perhaps unjust distribution of real resources between the capitalists, the landowners, and the wage earners. The foremost critic of capitalism in the 19th century, however, and in many months the foremost critic of capitalism in history, was Karl Marx. Marx was not just a critic of capitalism, but a fundamental critic of everything. In his book, Intellectuals, scholar Paul Johnson refers to Marx's style as being Talmudic. It's critical of everything. It's all commentary on those who have come before, and it's an attempt to criticize, dissect, and, in a sense, tear down the intellectual achievements of previous generations. Marx himself wrote at least one piece of work called, literally, A Critique of Critical Critique. And then finally, he had a very short essay called For a Ruthless Criticism of Everything Existing. So Marx offered criticism upon criticism upon criticism upon criticism of the capitalist system and claimed that it was unjust or unstable or irrational or prone to business cycles for a whole array of reasons. Marx's major error was to infer from the existence of criticism or from his criticisms that somehow in the future we would come up with something better. After the revolution, we would have pure socialism. And with the advent of pure socialism, we would get rational economic planning, the abolition of scarcity, and the onset of universal brotherhood. I'm going to pause for just a second and make what I think is a very, very important point about what the socialists promised. Because later, after Mises and Hayek would write, people would say, oh, well, you know, we were talking about how people can cooperate in scenarios that are not mediated by prices or in families, for example, where the means of production might be commonly owned. No. What the socialists, particularly those following Marx, argued was that the socialization of the means of production would lead to rational economic calculation, would lead to material superabundance, and would ultimately lead to the flowering and flourishing of universal brotherhood. If you watch the TV show South Park, they have a great episode that feature a group of little guys called the Underpants Gnomes. And the Underpants Gnomes have a grand scheme where what they're going to do is in phase one, they collect underpants. In phase two, something. Phase three, however, is profit. So phase one, collect underpants. Phase two, I don't know. Phase three, profit. Marx and those who followed him offered what is essentially an underpants gnomes theory of socialism and an underpants gnomes theory of the socialist transition. Phase one, socialize the means of production. Phase two, I don't know. Phase three, universal brotherhood and material superabundance. So, in Marx's stage theory of history, we move from primitivism to feudalism to capitalism to socialism, and the emergence of socialism would come with all the certainty of a law of history, and Marx would indeed denigrate those who might ask, well, how is this actually going to work? How is socialism as a social and economic system going to generate the material superabundance that you're promising? They had a theory that was every bit as good as the underpants gnomes theory of where profit was going to emerge from collected underpants. Phase one, socialize the means of production. Phase two, something. Phase three, universal brotherhood and material superabundance. Indeed, I'm reminded of a joke where a great communist orator is standing before a crowd and talking about how, you know, come the revolution, the rivers will flow with milk and honey. To which, you know, one of the comrades raises his hand and says, but I don't like milk and honey. The revolutionary paused for just a second. And he said, comrade, come the revolution, you will like milk and honey. So this, in a sense, is sort of the essence of the argument that's being brought forth by the proponents of socialism, who are focusing most of their time and energy and most of their attention on explaining how we're going to get to the socialist revolution and not what happens after the socialist revolution. So, as we go on over the course of the next several weeks, we're going to consider the contributions of Ludwig von Mises in his 1920 article, his 1920 article, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, and then Friedrich Hayek, in particular his 1945 article, The Use of Knowledge in Society. What the Austrian economists did is they offered us a very specific theoretical exploration of the question mark, specifically a theoretical exploration of phase two of the alleged socialist program. What happens between the socialization of the means of production and this material superabundance? Can this system itself actually work? Can it function as an economic system whereby people can engage in literally rational economic calculation? Let's go through a quick example. Okay, so imagine that you have Apu. So Apu runs the Quickie Mart, and Apu is going to be our stand-in for a socialist society. He asks, how do we make 10,000 squishies worth $3 each? So how do we produce $30,000 worth of output? This illustrates in part the brilliance of Mises as an expositor of fundamental economic truths. He's going to grant the best case scenario for the socialists. He's going to grant that we know what to produce, we know how to produce it, and we know perhaps how much it's worth. So we know the entire scale of social values, we know all of the resources at our disposal, and we know all of the possible technological combinations of those resources that will produce the output that we wish to see. So Apu's question is, how do we make 10,000 squishies worth $3 each? Let's consider what happens under private ownership of the means of production. Perhaps there are two ways to produce squishies. In the first case, he can use laborers to produce squishies using spoons. In another case, perhaps he can use maybe one worker and a machine that he can then use to produce these squishies. In the case of private ownership of the means of production, he knows that he needs to produce $30,000 worth of output, so 10,000 squishies that are worth $3 each. How do we know that? Well, under capitalism, he can infer from prices. Under socialism, we're just going to assume that somehow he knows that he needs to produce 10,000 squishies worth $3 each. He can observe prices of the means of production, and he can observe prices of labor that will show him that producing squishies with spoons would cost him $150,000, while producing squishies with squishy machines will only cost him $10,000. It's pretty clear that the best use of resources in this case, or the best way to produce the squishies, is to produce them using a machine. That's what happens in the case where we have private ownership of the means of production. Apu can go out into the market, he can buy spoons, he can hire labor, or he can go out, he can buy a squishy machine, which is going to involve all sorts of copper wiring and plastic and metal and all sorts of stuff combined into a squishy machine. It's clear that he's going to be able to calculate then the cost of production. He's going to be able to value what he has to give up in order to produce 10,000 squishies worth $3 each. In the case of common ownership of the means of production, however, he's not going to be able to do that. Let's pause and clarify for just a second. One of the fundamental economic problems, and indeed the fundamental economic problem that faces the socialists, according to Mises and Hayek, is even if we grant that we know exactly what to produce, we know all possible technological ways to produce it, and we know all of the resources that are at our disposal in order to produce, in the absence of private property, we don't have trade, we don't then form prices. We therefore cannot determine whether we're using our resources effectively. We can't know whether we're choosing wisely or choosing poorly when we decide on a particular method of producing, in this case, 10,000 squishies that are worth $3 each. To adopt the language of Mises specifically, we can't know whether we're producing squishies in a way that does not leave urgent wants unsatisfied. Let's see how exactly that is. Again, this is the common ownership example. Apu is thinking about producing squishies with spoons or producing squishies with machines. In the socialist case, in a case of common ownership of the means of production, no one owns spoons, no one owns machines, no one owns the inputs into any of the stuff, therefore none of it is traded, therefore prices don't form, therefore we have no idea what it costs us to produce squishies with spoons, and no idea what it costs us to produce squishies with machines. We cannot know which of these two methods economizes on factors of production. We cannot know which of these might leave urgent wants unsatisfied. To borrow from Hayek, as we'll read in Individualism and Economic Order a little bit later during our time together, Hayek says, you know, in the case of economic planning, under common ownership of the means of production, if you might have one production process that uses a lot of labor and relatively little capital, say the squishy with spoons case, and another production process that uses relatively little labor and a lot of capital. When you don't have private ownership of the means of production, there's no way to appraise the factors of production. There's no way to value labor, and there's no way to tell which of these is the rational way to produce squishies. And this is the case in a very simple example. We're assuming that we know exactly what we want to produce, 10,000 squishies. We know exactly what they're worth, which is $3 each. How do we know that? I don't know. Maybe God told the commissar that the objective cosmic value of these squishies is $3 a piece. And yet, even in this very simple case, we can't tell how to use So we're starting to get a couple of questions here. So these are things we'll take up in the Q&A. We can't know how to use the means of production so as to produce without wasting resources. The problem gets more extensive when we start adding people and adding production processes. There's probably an infinite number of ways to produce squishies. And furthermore, there's an infinite number of goals and an infinite number of ways to use the non-specific factors of production that go into the production of a squishy machine or that go into the production of squishies. Metal could be used to build, for example, a power plant. It could be used to create spoons. The spoons could be used to make squishies, or they could be used in the cafeteria at the power plant. Or the metal could be used to create a railing at Moe's Bar, or to create handles for the bathroom at Moe's Bar, something like that. There's no way to know necessarily what the best use of the steel and the resources are. Or who knows, maybe we want to use resources to produce comic books. We cannot know, in the absence of privately owned means of production, what the most effective, most efficient, resource-conserving way to produce output actually is. Okay, so there are a couple of implications here, and a couple of very specific implications of what Mises has to say about the possibility even of economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth. Let's consider what these are. First, when we have private property, we can trade. So we can trade private property. The exchange of private property is going to generate prices. It's going to generate ratios of money to goods that we can then use to make the kinds of comparisons and appraisements that we need to know whether we're using our resources wisely or whether we're using our resources unwisely. The existence of prices takes apples to oranges comparisons and turns them into apples to apples comparisons via a very simple conversion. The existence of prices for the means of production allows people to calculate profits and losses. In Apu's case, we knew what total revenue was going to be. And when we have private ownership of the means of production, we can know what the cost is going to be. We can know what we have to forego in order to engage in a particular production process, which in this case was producing 10,000 squishies, that were worth exactly $3 each. Our goal, or the goal of an entrepreneur, is going to be to maximize the difference between the revenue from a production process and the cost of a production process when that is as big as it can possibly get, then we know that the entrepreneur has chosen wisely. If it's small, then we know, I don't know, maybe the entrepreneur has chosen wisely. If it's negative, then we definitely know that the entrepreneur has chosen unwisely. This allows us to estimate opportunity costs. In other words, to estimate what we have to give up in order to get a particular factor of production, or in order to engage in a particular production process. This is the essence of what it means to engage in rational economic calculation. Conversely, the absence of private property means that goods are allocated not on the basis of exchange, but on the basis of some sort of centralized plan by whoever happens to be the spokesperson for the common good. The Central Planning Bureau is going to have to try to allocate real resources in the absence of private property rights. When there's no private property rights, there can be no trade. Literally, if I'm not allowed to have title to my property, then there's no way I can trade that to anybody. So the absence of private property means the absence of exchange. The absence of exchange means the absence of prices. So when there's no exchange, there's no prices. And when what we said a minute ago is that the emergence of prices takes the apples to oranges comparisons that are inherent in any human decision and turns them into apples to apples comparisons that can be reckoned in terms of money. The absence of prices means that there are no profits and losses. The absence of profits and losses mean that there is no rational economic calculation. Now, a lot of people, a lot of the critics of Mises, for example, said, oh, well, no, clearly you can have rational economic calculation in primitive societies. You can have rational economic calculation in families in the absence of prices and in the absence of exchange. What the Mises and Hayek critique of socialism says is not that voluntary cooperation is impossible unless we have prices, and it is not that there cannot be exchanges among people that are not mediated by prices. For example, I have two small children. I have a 2.5-year-old son and a 9-month-old daughter. I'm not keeping a running tab of charges that I'm going to bill them for someday for changing diapers and providing meals and doing bath time and nap time and things like that. It's very, very clear that we can have all sorts of private human interactions that are not, in fact, mediated by prices. But there's a difference between saying that people can cooperate through non-price channels and we can have a complex industrial society without private ownership of the means of production and without, therefore, the emergence of prices. Mises argues that every step we take away from private ownership of the means of production and every step we take towards socialism is a step away from rational economic behavior. So if the concept of economy, if the concept of economizing, if economic behavior is going to mean anything, it has to mean conserving resources and it has to mean economizing on scarce resources and making sure that we're not wasting anything in the pursuit of our various goals. So let's consider a couple of objections to this thesis that private ownership is possible, or to our thesis that rational economic calculation is impossible, or that capitalism is in any sense desirable. So some people might grant, and indeed they do today, that capitalism is great in that it delivers the goods, but it's not beautiful. I mentioned G.A. Cohen's book, Why Not Socialism, earlier, and I encourage you to look up, I reviewed it for the Freeman, David Gordon reviewed it for the Mises Review, and James Otteson reviewed it for the Independent Review. Cohen's argument, even after granting that, okay, yeah, sure, maybe socialism is not inevitable, socialism is still desirable because it is an ethically better system than capitalism. Well, there's a handful of objections to the capitalist system. One is that perhaps it's unjust. You know, capitalism is unjust because the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The historical data do not bear this out. If you read chapter 14 of Gregory Clark's excellent book, A Farewell to Alms, he points out that there's a difference between the predictions of David Ricardo, the predictions of Karl Marx, and the predictions of neoclassical economics and the actual facts of economic history. Ricardo argued that of the way that factor payments could be split, they could be split between owners of land, owners of capital, and owners of labor. Ricardo argued that all income would be absorbed by the owners of land and natural resources. Marx argued that all of the income would be absorbed not by the owners of land, but by the owners of capital. The odd people out in this case would be laborers, and in particular, unskilled laborers who would forever persist on the margins of subsistence. The actual facts, though, of the last 2.5 centuries have been that land rents have remained unchanged. So the price of land adjusted for inflation basically hasn't changed. The return on capital, the interest rate, also basically hasn't changed. So all of the benefits from industrialization, they haven't gone to capitalists and they haven't gone to landowners. The thing that has exploded in the last 2.5 centuries has been unskilled wages. So contra Marx, and in precisely the opposite of what he predicted, we got not a progressive immiseration of the working class, but a progressive enrichment of the working class, such that almost all of the benefits of industrialization have gone primarily to not just any labor, but to unskilled labor. Some argue that, well, be that as it may, capitalism is just not beautiful. You know, it's individualistic, and we shouldn't be individualistic. We should pursue the common good. An important idea to keep in mind is anytime we propose an ought, anytime we say that something should be this way, we're implicitly assuming that it's possible. So if we want to make an ethical critique or offer an ethical critique of capitalism, and we want to offer an ethical apology for socialism, we have to assume that socialist economy, that economic calculation is in fact possible in the socialist commonwealth. But Mises and Hayek, again, demonstrate that it isn't. We're going to handle a handful of other critiques or a handful of other criticisms of capitalism a little bit later in the course. But for now, let's finish up by considering exactly what Mises and Hayek bring to the table. I mentioned a moment ago that anytime you have an ought, you're presupposing a can. So when you say that something, that society ought to be this way, you're assuming that it can be that way. If you're assuming people ought to plan society, you're assuming that they can plan society rationally and as a substitute for the voluntary interactions of private individuals operating on the free market. Again, Mises and then Hayek in 1945, they stack the decks against themselves, and this I think is an exercise in absolutely excellent cognitive citizenship. They stack the decks against themselves, and in Mises' case, assumes without warrant the best possible case for the socialist planners. He assumes that they know what should be produced. He assumes that they know all of the technologically possible ways to produce the entire array of output, and he assumes that we know all of the available resources at our disposal. Even given these assumptions, he demonstrates that they still cannot calculate rationally. They still cannot figure out how to produce society's output, even given, again, that we know exactly what it is, in a way that minimizes costs and that leaves no more urgent wants left unmet in order to meet less urgent wants. And that, I think, is a very, very powerful criticism and an insurmountable critique, not just of socialism writ large, but also of virtually any interventionist scheme. What Mises and Hayek offer is essentially robust political economy. They make the best possible assumptions on behalf of those that they're attempting to refute. Then they show that that various socialist schemes are not possible. Various socialist schemes cannot eventuate in rational economic calculation. When we start to change the fundamental assumptions that Mises and Hayek are making, it only makes their case stronger. So Mises and Hayek are assuming that the planners have perfect knowledge of what should be produced. Once we relax that assumption, then it becomes unclear how the planners are going to find out exactly what it is that they should produce. This becomes then Hayek's contribution in his 1945 article, is saying, you know, once we begin being a little bit more realistic, and even perhaps if we assume that Mises is wrong and Mises is not wrong, that the economic problem changes and changes in a fundamental way. We have to figure out what to produce. We have to figure out how to produce it. And then furthermore, when we change assumptions about the incentives being faced by the people who are doing the planning or the people who are doing the intervening, then the case for the Mises story and the Hayek story about the superiority of capitalism, I think, ultimately becomes unassailable. We discussed this a little bit recently in my introductory economics class. We talked very briefly about political economy and about the decisions that are made by people who are acting on behalf of the state. Even if we assume that there are scenarios in which markets might fail, if you've taken an introductory economics class, you've probably drawn pictures in which you show that markets might fail because of externalities or because of monopoly power or incomplete information or something like that. When we begin to make realistic assumptions about the incentives of the people who are actually making the decisions and doing the intervening, then again, I think the case against the state and the case for the market becomes much, much, much stronger. Mises and Hayek assume that the central planners and that anyone who works for the government is always and everywhere going to be acting in the public interest. They assume that they're acting in the interests of not even necessarily the people who elected them. I mean, we don't know what the political institutions are, but they're acting in the interests of all of the members of the citizenry. A more realistic assumption might say that they act in their own private interest. So instead of acting in the public interest, they act in their own private interest, and they seek to maximize the degree to which they get goodies from the state. They might act in the public interest. They might act in the private interest. Often they're going to act in the special interest. So what they're going to do is they're effectively going to sell themselves to the highest bidder, almost literally, and say, I will give you all of the goodies that you want. I'll give you all the goodies that you might that I might be able to procure for you, and I will do it at a price. It's not at all clear that the people who are doing the intervening are going to be in a position to best estimate and best understand exactly what it is that the public wants. And further, it's not clear that their interests are going to be perfectly aligned or even properly aligned with the interest of those in society. If you've taken, if you've taken a management class or if you've taken upper-level economics classes at all, you might have heard of something called the Burleyan means problem, named after Adolf Burley and Gardner Means, who in the mid-20th century, and in fact, actually, given this is a Mises Academy course, I would encourage you to look up on Mises.org some of Tom DiLorenzo's lectures from Mises University's past on competition and antitrust. By way of aside, I periodically refer to these lectures when I'm teaching this kind of material in some of my classes. But anyway, Burley and Means pointed out the problem of the separation of ownership and control. And they said the fundamental problem of the corporation is that you have a board of directors and a CEO and a group of executives and then a body of stockholders. Those who own the firm are not the ones who are controlling the firm, and therefore the executives might have the wrong incentives and might not act in the shareholders' best interest, and therefore the corporate form is going to necessarily be inefficient and perhaps is going to be undesirable. It's a fallacy to infer from that we can improve on it with government intervention, because if the CEO of a company in which I own stock is not going to act in my best interests, it's almost certain that a regulator who is not beholden to me in any way, shape, or form is not going to act in my best interests, but is in fact going to act in the interests of whoever happens to be the highest bidder. So the case for capitalism and the case for socialism is extremely robust, and that is what we're going to be exploring over the next 4 weeks. Within the next couple of days, I'm going to have a quiz up based on my notes on this lecture, and I'll have another quiz based on the readings for the for our next meeting, when we're going to talk about economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth, and perhaps a couple of other things. And I'm happy now to turn it over to you guys to answer any questions that you might have. So there's one. There's one that came up a minute ago that I think is a very, very good place to start. So Gregor Bruner, who is writing from Montreal, asks, but aren't prices estimated by bureaucrats in socialism? Yes. Yes, they are. Bureaucrats estimate prices. And in socialist economies, and in particular in the actually existing socialist economies that we've observed in the 20th century, they're able to estimate prices by looking at the prices of goods that are traded in the global marketplace. So the Soviet Union was able to exist and persist for as long as it was able to, and was able to emulate rational capitalist planning by observing the prices that emerged in capitalist countries like the United States and like the capitalist countries of Europe. So they were able to plan, quote unquote, on the basis of prices that were formed by they were able to plan on the basis of prices that were formed in capitalist countries and on well-functioning capitalist markets around the world. Consider two examples. The first is a joke. An old Soviet commissar once said, "So our goal in the Soviet Union is to see the entire world, every country in the world except for New Zealand, turn to socialism or turn to communism." And so someone asked, "Well, why not New Zealand?" And he said, "Well, we have to get the prices somewhere." So this is an important point. The prices have to come from somewhere, and if a socialist economy can use the world prices, if a socialist economy can use world prices, then they can engage in something that at least almost sort of maybe kind of resembles rational economic calculation. Consider also the case of Cuba. I talked about Cuba today in one of my classes. Cuba is able to continue to exist as a communist country in part because they're surrounded by an international marketplace where you can get reliable prices of pretty much any good that you want. So Cuba is able to plan, and I'm going to put plan in very, very big quotes here because their planning is terrible, their institutions are terrible, but nonetheless, they're able to at least make some plans about how to produce stuff, what to produce, when to produce it, where to produce it, etc. Incidentally and parenthetically, I think one of the problems that we've made in the United States with the Cuban embargo is we've given them a very, very convenient enemy. Fidel Castro has been able to say for years, one of the reasons why the Cuban economy is not growing is because we can't trade with the United States. Okay, it's true they can't trade with the United States, but they trade freely with just about every other country in the world. So they have the benefits of global free trade. What's happening is that their socialist institutions are what has resulted in the complete destruction of the Cuban economy over the last 5 or 6 decades. And tragically, I think, they have a very convenient scapegoat just a few miles north in the United States. One of the important problems of central planning is the way that the plans are actually going to be taken into account, or the actual ways that the plans are going to be done. So in the absence of prices, in the absence of value, in the absence of profits and losses, you need some way to measure output. Now, it should be pretty obvious when you consider something like nails. If you have a quota of nails and say, well, what you need to do is produce 10 million nails this year, then you're going to get lots and lots and lots of teeny tiny itty-bitty little nails that are about the size of thumbtacks. They're not going to be useful for very much. But, hey, you'll meet your quota of nails. Presumably, what's going to happen then is that whoever's running the nail factory is going to get sent to the gulag, and they're going to say, okay, well, no. What we need is not 10 million nails, but 10,000 tons of nails. Joseph Salerno, in his lectures on economic calculation, that he's given at Mises University and that you can find online at Mises.org, talks about a cartoon that he saw one time where you've got the planner standing next to another guy and saying, hey, look, we met our nail quota. And there's an 18-wheeler driving by with a gigantic nail on the bed. So there's so this indicates that they met their quota of 10,000 tons of nails just with one nail. To abstract from communist humor for a second and talk about the actual tragedy of communism, there was a problem for a while in some of the dashas in which some of the party upper level officials were spending their time, with chandeliers coming crashing out of the ceiling and killing people. Why? Because the way that planning was done in the chandelier industry was they measured output by the total weight of chandeliers that are produced. So you have these enormous, incredibly heavy chandeliers that are going to be very, very difficult to support in a standard ceiling, and that are going to come ripping out of the ceiling and killing people. So there's a great human tragedy involved in the very, very, very simple set of errors that socialism constitutes. Okay, so let's pick a couple of other questions coming in. Okay, so from Steve Chipman, what generally has been the response to Mises' economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth over the years, and did this change when communism collapsed in 1989 to 1991? Okay, so here I'm ashamed of my discipline, the glorious science of economics, because for the longest time we thought Mises was wrong. By we, I mean everybody who came before me. I was 10 in 1989, so I didn't really have much to contribute to the debate that was taking place in the 70s and 80s. But most economists would have thought, okay, yeah, Mises raised a number of important ideas and perhaps a number of important objections, but as Abel Lerner and some others would later demonstrate, yeah, a socialist economy can calculate, and even Hayek admitted that a socialist economy can calculate. I'm going to defer to people who are really experts on Hayek, Joseph Salerno being one, Peter Betke, Stephen Horowitz, Guido Hulsman, Hans-Hermann Hoppe, Walter Block. There's a whole array of people, the people from whom I have learned all of this stuff, who know far more about the Mises, the relationship between Mises and Hayek than I do. First, I don't know that that's a correct reading of Hayek to say that he admitted that in principle economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth is possible. But the argument was that, well, Mises is fundamentally wrong, and Hayek said that, yeah, perhaps they could calculate. It would just be really inefficient. I think part of Hayek's argument, and we'll get into this a little bit later, is that it's not just a question of when we talk about calculation, we're not talking about whether people can solve a very, very big system of equations using a whole lot of computing power. I mean, obviously, if you take a big enough computer, virtually any gigantic system of equations, no matter how complex, is probably going to be able to produce a unique solution. Excuse me. Hayek argued that's fundamentally not what we mean necessarily by calculation. So being able to perform a mathematical exercise is not the same thing as being able to engage in rational economic calculation. One of the socialists, I think it was Lerner, said, "Oh, you know, okay, well, Mises showed us the way, and that there should be a statue of Mises in the Central Planning Bureau because he showed us that prices and exchange are necessary for rational economic calculation, but lo and behold, socialist economies can do it. Nonetheless, we should honor Mises for his contribution because he showed us that here's the problem that we really need to solve. And presto, we solved it." I think that was the state of the art in the economics profession for most of the post-World War II era. And indeed, as late as the 1980s, Paul Samuelson's economics textbook, which was the leading textbook in introductory economics, was saying that it's only a matter of time before the Soviet Union passes the United States in terms of per capita income. They pointed to the USSR as proof of the proposition that a socialist economy can calculate rationally and that a socialist economy can, in fact, not just exist, but even thrive. And then after communism fell, this was the great vindication of Mises and the great vindication of Hayek, and scholars who went in and started looking at Soviet production statistics noticed that they're pretty much all lies. the most of the data were made up. And then in many cases, by virtue of the fact that we could not, that most of the consumption goods and producers' goods in communist countries were not traded on formal markets, we couldn't really even compare output from country to country. So, for example, so one thing that might be done would be to say, okay, so Soviet Motors produced 10,000 cars, and okay, well, we're not really sure how to value these cars because they're not traded, they don't have prices don't really mean anything. Let's find something comparable. Okay, so Ford Motor Company also produced 10,000 cars, and they sold those 10,000 cars for $10,000 each. So they sold these cars for $10,000 each, and so let's value all of these Soviet cars at $10,000 each. Oh, lo and behold, the Soviet Union has produced $100 million worth of cars. 10,000 cars could be sold for $10,000 each. Never mind the fact that, you know, some of the cars didn't have engines, and some of them didn't have windshields, and some of them were too heavy to travel, and most of them were absolute garbage. Still, we estimated in a very, very crude way Soviet output, but it turned out that Soviet output was nowhere near the quality of Western output, in large part because people just didn't have the right incentives or the right information. Okay, so I was saying that ought always implies a can. Shouldn't one first explore how just something is and look at how to put it in practice afterwards? Okay, so that's I think that the way that I would think about that is in conversations that I have with philosophers, particularly philosophers of the classical liberal bent, before we can really know what's just, in a sense, we probably have to know what's possible. My friend James Otteson, who's a philosopher at Yeshiva University in New York, was saying that, you know, saying that often philosophers might say, well, here, wouldn't it be nice if ... wouldn't it be great if we had a society in which, say, everybody was fed, clothed, sheltered, etc. And I told him that, you know, that often when I hear people saying, oh, well, what we need a just society with common ownership of the means of production and adequate food, clothing, and shelter for everyone, I hear Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys start singing, wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice if we could whatever? So I'm a little bit wary of trying to develop an articulated view of what the just society looks like and then trying to implement it, because first of all, it's incredibly impractical. Second of all, it rarely acknowledges the constraints that are produced by the social environment, the physical environment, the technological environment, and whatnot. And third, at the risk of being dramatic, it's a mode of thinking that is associated with a body count 260 million piles deep. Excuse me, 260 million bodies deep in the 20th century. So attempts to articulate and implement someone's vision of a just society cost a whole lot of people their lives in the 20th century. A fantastic book that I've read recently that I would recommend, actually a couple of fantastic books that I've recommend recent that I've read recently. One is called Bloodlands. I cannot for the life of me remember the author's name, but it's one of the first books I read on my Kindle, and it's about the struggle for Eastern Europe between the Nazis on one side and the Soviets on the other, and the sheer inhumanity of this entire exercise absolutely boggled the mind. The degree to which human beings would butcher other human beings in the pursuit of some poorly articulated social goal really, really saddened me at a fundamental level. The second is a book that is available for a price of $0 you can download from Mises.org, and it's by Ralph Rako. It's a name that a lot of you might find familiar. It's called, I believe the title is Great Leaders and Great Wars. It's either Great Leaders and Great Wars or Great Wars and Great Leaders. I think it's Great Leaders and Great Wars. The subtitle is A Libertarian Rebuttal, and it discusses American foreign policy in the 20th century and also the history of war as it took place in the 20th century and a lot of the unintended consequences of that. So to come around full circle, and to fully answer your question, when you say we ought to do something, you're generally assuming that we can do that. And I think, you know, at least from my perspective in the intellectual division of labor, it's best at times to explore what is possible rather than what might be desirable in the absence of constraints. I welcome you if you have a Twitter account. You can follow me at Art Carden. The other day, I posted something as I was getting ready for a makeup session for my Econ 100 class, saying that people have described politics as the art of the possible. If anything, public choice economics is the art of showing that the possible is wildly improbable or wildly implausible. All right, so with that, I'm happy to take any other questions. Okay, excellent. Okay, so Eric Park says, it's Great Wars and Great Leaders, a libertarian rebuttal. I'm about halfway through the book. It's great. Okay, cool. So do I agree with Mises that there is no such thing as a mixed economy? You'll have to point me to the passage in Mises in which he says that, and specifically the context. I know he has an excellent essay called Middle of the Road Policy Leads to Socialism, that's an excellent companion to Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. I think that intervention, the dynamics of interventionism, suggest that eventually socialism is the end state. So pure capitalism is a precarious equilibrium, and once we intervene and start intervening in a capitalist system, then we're going to end up careening down the slippery slope to socialism or tyranny, even. It might take a very, very, very long time. And fortunately, in countries like the United States, we've done a very, very good job, I think, managing the excesses of the state. But even still, it bothers me just a tiny little bit. I was having a discussion. So over the weekend, we hosted an Institute for Humane Studies weekend seminar. And we were having a discussion at lunch, and we were talking about the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And one of the things that the UN Declaration says is that everyone has a right to paid leave and leisure from their job. And so the question was, will this actually impoverish the workers? We maintain that yes, it will, because employers are not going to care about the composition of the costs that they're paying. So here we go. Article explains Mises' no third way position, overt and covert socialisms. Okay. So that's worth looking into. Parenthetically, I also remember reading somewhere, Murray Rothbard said about one of his discussions with Mises, he said, so where do you draw the line between a capitalist society and a socialist society? And Mises said the existence of a stock market. No matter how much intervention there is, an economy is still fundamentally capitalist at its core, as long as it has a stock market, as long as it has an ownership, as long as it has a market in which ownership of the means of production can be traded. Let's see. Getting back to where I was a second ago, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. People objected to the idea that the poor could be impoverished by mandated leave. And so we said, well, okay, so let's pass a law and say have mandated leave. We asked, you know, can you repeal the laws of supply and demand with a UN declaration? The answer to that is obviously no. So if we mandate that people around the world have to be paid, they have to receive, in addition to their wages, say two weeks of paid vacation. Okay, let me check. Okay, here we go. I'm trying to make the chat window a little bit bigger. then they're going to get lower wages. So someone responded, well, okay, then you just pass a law saying you're not allowed to lower wages. Okay, well, so you passed a law saying that you have to provide 2 weeks of paid vacation. You passed another law saying you're not allowed to lower wages. Well, in that case, then you just fire people because they're going to be lots of workers who are no longer worth hiring, given that the value of the marginal product of their labor is going to be lower than the marginal cost of employing them. So the next step, obviously, was we have to pass a law saying you're not allowed to fire anybody. Okay, what happens then? Then you have all of these businesses that start losing money and that therefore have to go out of business. What do you do then? Well, you pass a law saying you're not allowed to go out of business, or you socialize these means of production or something like that. So you go from, in this case, relatively quickly from a seemingly innocuous proposition saying that the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights should be binding and people should have 2 weeks of paid vacation to intervention upon intervention upon intervention. Mises himself describes what he calls or describes the dynamics of intervention as being one law being passed to correct and fix the unintended consequences of the laws that were passed to deal with the last crisis. Okay, so let's see what we have here. Okay, wow. It's a very, very nice pile of questions. Let's see here. Okay, is there a difference between socialism and communism, or did I miss this while stepping out for a moment? I really don't think that there is in a meaningful sense. I generally use the terms interchangeably in classes. I talk about communism being the last stage of socialism in a sense. It's sort of like a millennial view of once we've worked out all the full, beautiful, wonderful things of socialism, then that's what we're ultimately going to call communism. Let's see here. Mises is no third way position, and I'm very much with Mises on this. Very much with Hayek and Rothbard on this as well. In that I don't think there's a middle. I don't think there's a practical or feasible middle ground. I think if you ask a question about comparing government interventions, saying okay, one intervention is probably better than or worse than another. So, for example, if you say we have to have some intervention that's going to raise the incomes of the poor, minimum wages obviously will not. The earned income tax credit is obviously superior if strictly the goal is to raise the incomes of the poor. When we ask questions about justice, and when we ask questions about whether we're increasing the total pile of social wealth, then that changes dramatically. Let's see. What are some of the fundamental differences between Hitler's fascism and Soviet Bolshevism? Were not both systems centrally planned? Can fascism be considered socialism? Yes. Okay, fascism and socialism, or fascism and communism, are very, very, very much the same thing. I'm going to – forgive me for just a second. I'm going to look and see if I have Thomas Sowell's new book. Okay, I don't. It's at home. I thought I had Sowell's book, Intellectuals in Society, which I'm reviewing for Economic Affairs, and that should be ready soon. Oh, my goodness. I forget who he quotes. I want to say it was someone like W.E.B. Du Bois who said that, this is before the madness of Hitler was revealed. He said that next to Soviet Russia, Nazi Germany was the fullest expression of Marxian socialism. So, unfortunately, I think a lot of people, you might have had discussions like this. A lot of people see fascism and Nazism as the polar opposite of communism, and we need to find some sort of middle ground between the two. No, that's absolutely not the case. I mean, both are socialist movements. You know, indeed, national socialism based on explicit racism versus international socialism based on not really even sure what to call it, slaughtering all of the enemies of humanity or something like that. Let's see. Okay. Okay, so here's Mises. The market. So okay, so thank you, thank you. So here's a quote from Stephen Davis, from this article. So Mises says the market, and I quote, "The market economy must be strictly differentiated from the second thinkable, although not realizable, system of social cooperation under the division of labor, the system of social or governmental ownership of the means of production. The second system is commonly called socialism, communism, planned economy, or state capitalism. The market economy, or capitalism, as it is usually called, and the socialist economy preclude one another. There's no mixture of the two systems possible or thinkable. There's no such thing as a mixed economy, a system that would be in part capitalist and in part socialist. Production is directed by the market or by the decrees of a production czar or a committee of production czars." Okay, so that's basically the idea. I agree with Mises there that there's no third way, and indeed someone asks about this a little bit later, is this idea of a third way, is it consistent with, or is it just socialism in disguise? I think ultimately that it is. Most people would probably not identify it as socialist, and indeed I think President Obama would call for socialization of some means of production, like healthcare, for example. But it's not at all clear that he would call for socialism of all the means of production. Okay, so let's see here. Okay, so Mises. Okay, from Jennifer Longo, "Is it true that the law of supply and demand is just a means for those who control prices to cause inflation or lower prices without a real reason?" No, it's not. The law of supply and demand just says that as prices go up, people do more of something. As prices go down, they do less of it, or they supply more of something, they supply less of something. As prices go up, people demand less of something. As prices go down, they demand more of it. Now, the important constraint here, the important constraint on all of this is competition. So there's a difference between being able to say, so the local Kroger at which we shop, that they can, you know, that they can change prices as they wish. You know, that they can change, that they can pay nothing to their workers and charge us $500 for a bottle of milk, but they're fundamentally constrained by competition. Here I'm gonna borrow another story from Joseph Salerno, and he was talking about going in to buy a car one time, and the car salesman comes up and says, "Hey, what do you want to pay? What are you looking to spend?" And Joe said, "Nothing," which I think that's a brilliant answer. It's precisely consistent with the economic way of thinking. I don't want to spend anything. The next time I go to buy a car, I just want someone to give it to me. What constrains me, what constrains my ability to demand a car for nothing, is the fact that someone else is going to walk through the car, through the door of the dealership eventually, and offer money for it. So, let's see. Just third way seems to be socialism hiding in plain sight. Is this true? Probably. Let's see here. So law of supply and demand means for those control prices to cause inflation or lower prices without a real reason. So after thinking about that for a second, and that's what I've just been talking about, I want to take that a little bit more seriously. Because often you will hear interventionists claim that, oh, yeah, this is just the free market work. This is free enterprise. We believe in free enterprise. We believe in capitalism. We believe in the laws of supply and demand. That's bizarre in a way for someone to say, well, we have price controls because we need to have because we need to save free enterprise. George W. Bush said in 2007-2008, you know, we need to sacrifice the principles of the free market in order to save the free market. I'm sure you could, you know, if we wanted to, we could spend the rest of the night going through examples like that. It is true, and so this isn't a class on banking. This is not a class on the Fed. But so this morning I went and I needed to buy some supplies for an in-class demonstration that I do, and I bought a jug of this blue drink. It's called like blue raspberry artificially flavored beverage. I think it was the actual title. It said 0% juice on it, and in the past, when I've gone to buy this, even with my Kroger Plus Club card, it's cost like a buck. Now, with my Kroger Plus Club card, it cost $1.19. So that's not necessarily the pure workings of supply and demand. The higher sticker price is a result of monetary inflation. Let's see here. Okay, so why does material inefficiency matter? Shouldn't happiness be the measure of wealth? Aside from the true example of leaders fulfilling self-interest, perhaps the yardstick shouldn't be the greatest aggregate economic wealth. Americans aren't happy. I would dispute that. I think that the evidence suggests that yes, Americans are reasonably happy, and indeed that there's a strong positive correlation between material wealth and happiness. I obviously don't think that material wealth is the only thing that matters, and indeed my chosen profession suggests that that might be the case, or at least that's what academics like to flatter themselves into thinking. If we wanted happiness to be the measure of wealth, well, we can fix that easily by just loading up a water supply with Prozac. I mean, we do that, everybody, with enough Prozac, and everybody's going to be happy. So while I'm very sympathetic to the view that money, that we should be like, in a sense, we should be like the Beatles. You know, money, we don't care too much for money because money can't buy us love. It can buy us a lot of stuff that inputs into love and that will ultimately help us to attain happiness. Now, it's easy, and I want to dwell on this again for just a second, because this is where sort of my economics intersects with my ethics. It's very easy to denounce modern technology, and it's very easy to talk about how alienated and demoralized we are with modern capitalism. But I am very, very grateful for modern capitalism, modern technology, and the profit motive when my kids are sick, for example. You know, I am not in any way, shape, or form alienated and demoralized by children's Motrin when my son has a fever of 105 or something to that effect. I think it's easy to talk about how there are higher values, but when the rubber hits the road, material, you know, we can't eat people's good intentions. I can't feed my family with the fact that people mean well. I can feed them with real income. Let's see. And for those of you out there who are like me are sort of devotees of Thomas Sowell, you'll recognize that sounds an awful lot like some things that he says in some of his books. Let's see. Okay. So Danny Sanchez from the Mises Institute is posting some great stuff in the chat box. Let's see. From Gregor, okay, so which form of capitalism do you desire? What role should government have? I become a more confirmed anarchist by the day. I don't believe that government is necessary, and I don't believe that government is legitimate. Now, I am not willing to storm the barricades for that right now because I think, again, that for all of its problems and imperfections, we lead a pretty nice life right now. But the more I study it again, The more I come to realize that I just don't think the state is necessary. Christopher Coyne from George Mason University and I are currently finishing a project on the 1866 Memphis race riot. And one of the standard claims for why we need government is to provide police protection and fire protection. This is an example in which there was a massive race riot in which local citizens in Memphis slaughtered African-Americans by the dozens, practically. And the mob itself was actually led by the cops. And in some cases, houses were burned by members of the fire department. In some cases, they would go and they would knock on a door of, so like, I don't know, say Joe White or something like that, and say, okay, Mr. White, Mr. Black lives next door, and we're going to burn his house. We're just going to make sure that we're not going to interfere with you in the process. So this suggests to me that for all of the imperfections in the world, the last thing we want to do is legitimize more violence. Let's see here. Okay, which form of capital? Okay, so that's a question there. Okay, not sure if I saw this. Is there an objective index that evaluates? Okay, so yeah. So thanks for reposting. An objective index that evaluates the progressive scale of a society's movement towards either socialism or capitalism, i.e., if we were to evaluate where America is today, since there is no pure capitalist or socialist society today, could we determine where we are? In other words, major factors evaluated, analyzed, and then placed on an index. Not sure who would be doing this, but would be interesting. That's a great question, because while there is not an objective measure, as in, like, we can't peer into the mind of God and say, okay, here's the objective definition of capitalism, objective definition of socialism, there are a couple of organizations that produce indices of economic freedom. The Fraser Institute produces the Economic Freedom of the World Index. So go to freetheworld.com, and you can get the Economic Freedom of the World Index. Robert Lawson, who's getting ready to leave Auburn University to go to Southern Methodist University in Dallas, is the point person for the Economic Freedom of the World Index. I've written a paper with Bob and another paper with Lisa Verdon from the College of Worcester, in which we use these data to talk about, in the paper with Lisa, corruption, and in the paper with Bob, human rights. And then the Wall Street Journal and the Heritage Foundation produce another index of economic freedom that is also extremely useful for empirical work. Are they perfect? No. Are they imperfect? Yes. Are they the best things we have currently? Yeah. So let's see here. Can I explain economic calculation in a fascist society? Also, what do you call a society where it is a secret private group such as a cartel but controlling the whole economy? Okay, so secret private group such as a cartel controlling the whole economy, either a fascist or a socialist society. I think one of the differences between fascism and socialism is that under fascism, at least there is nominal private ownership of at least some of the means of production, and so thus rational economic calculation is a little bit more possible than it is under socialism. But when there's a society with a secret private group controlling the whole economy, that's either socialism or fascism. Gregor, not even national defense or enforcing rights for private property. Okay, so let's take both of those, because these are fantastic questions. National defense. That's a tough question, because national defense is close to an argument for a pure public good. And if you want to, send me an email, and we'll talk about difficult cases for the market, like public goods externalities, a little bit later. For now, look up – there's a book that Hans Hoppe edited, and parenthetically, one of the reasons why I do things like this on behalf of the Mises Institute is because I believe strongly in their educational mission. And the fact that they make so much stuff available for a price of $0 online is positively amazing. The book that I want you to check out is edited by Hans Hoppe, and it's called The Myth of National Defense. From a very practical perspective, one of the reasons why I don't think national defense is as much of a public good as we might want, as we might claim, is that it also has a possibility of being a public bad. Right now we're now involved. The Americans are now involved in three shooting wars in the Middle East. And it's not at all clear to me that these are necessary. Okay, great, excellent. So Chris Branko points out that Robert Murphy has also written on private defense. Actually, yeah, Bob has a great article on options contracts and private defense, which I think is also available on Mises.org. But we are like I said, we're currently involved in three shooting wars in the Middle East. I think that the creation of that kind of military infrastructure helps to encourage aggression. Let's see. Okay, enforcing rights for private property. That is a worthwhile goal of the state, but I don't think it's necessary. I would look up, again, Hoppe, Murray Rothbard's The Ethics of Liberty. Okay, oh, great. Well, thank you. Murray Rothbard's The Ethics of Liberty. Also takes up a lot of issues like this. And then there's a philosopher and lawyer who teaches in the business school at Georgetown named John Hasnas, Hasnas. He has a great article called The Obviousness of Anarchy that you should probably be able to find. And he discusses in detail the evolution of private legal systems and private mechanisms for the evolution of property rights protection. Okay, so if not national defense, then what? Private defense. Yeah. So Bob Murphy's book Chaos Theory is also very, very good. Is there any sort of major difference between Ayn Rand's objectivist philosophy and the capitalist philosophy, or are they more or less the same thing? Okay, so I'm very sympathetic to Rand on a lot of different margins, and Atlas Shrugged is my favorite novel. Capitalism is an economic system rather than a philosophy. Objectivism is a philosophical system that includes capitalism as its economics. So there are ways of thinking about capitalism that are subsets of objectivism. So objectivism is a bigger umbrella than capitalism. It includes a way of thinking about capitalism that doesn't exclude all ways of thinking about capitalism from being, in a sense, non-objectivist. Honestly, I'm not sure that made any sense. There are a lot of ways of thinking about capitalism. Objectivism is one of them, and objectivism is a philosophical system that that advances capitalism as proper economics. Okay, so Murphy, so Robert Murphy has written a lot. Chaos Theory is great. If not national defense, then what? Private defense. Okay, so yeah, absolutely, private defense. This gets to another question from David Cheney, who asks, what is a worthwhile public good in my view? One of the only things I can think of is being a genuine public good. A couple of things I can think of actually being genuine public goods. First, the global climate. Second, defense against an asteroid striking the planet and killing everybody. Those, I think, are the only – as close as I can get to pure public goods. Public goods are non-rival and non-excludable. Asteroid defense is about as close as it gets. Okay, so you don't view fascism as a form of socialism. I really don't know that much, honestly, about fascism, because it's one of those words that gets sort of thrown around to describe anything and everything bad. At least nominally, fascism involves some private property, some private ownership of the means of production, but centrally directed. So in that sense, it's very much socialistic. It is very much a type of socialism, but still, at least some of the means of production are privately owned. Was Myth of National Defense the best book on private defense? I don't actually know. Why don't I buy Rothbard's argument about air pollution? I totally buy Rothbard's argument about air pollution, but that's something we can talk about a little bit later. I'm more sympathetic to Coase and Demsitz than are Rothbard and Block. So would protection from environmental disaster also be a public good? Protection from environmental harm. So your public goods comment about the environment led me to think otherwise. Gotcha. Okay. Clever. So would protection from environmental disaster also be a public good, or even protection from environmental harm? Well, here I'm going to continue the discussion that Stephen Davis brought up on Rothbard's argument about air pollution, public goods, and the environment. There's a very easy way, or very easy set of ways, I think, to privatize protection from environmental disaster and protection from environmental harm. Okay, now, why would that be the case? Because of the common law of torts, we can evolve legal institutions that will take care of things like air pollution and things of that nature. Murray Rothbard's classic article, Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution, is, I think, the definitive source on this. All right, so it's about 7. So my clock says 7:35. I think it's about – yeah, okay. So, yeah, both of the clocks in my office say 7:35. So I'm happy to take one more question if anybody has anything. Okay, here we go. Socialism and malinvestment and bubbles. Austrian business cycle theory explains how we get bubbles and malinvestment through government control of the interest rate, socializing the cost of money. Wouldn't socialism in other areas, healthcare, GM, I assume is General Motors, cause similar malinvestment in bubbles. I hear a lot on how socialism is possible, but not quite so much on the effects it will have on an economy when it is attempted. Are we aware of any good research on this area? Okay, so the empirical research on the effects of socialism is pretty much anything that's been written about the 20th century, and I'm not being glib when I say that. And when we talk about socialism being impossible, it's impossible as an economic system. Socialism in other areas, would it cause similar malinvestment and bubbles? Malinvestment, yes. Bubbles, I don't really know about. I mean, that there's a difference between money and all other goods because of the way that money affects interest rates. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any good research on that. And I think if there's anybody in the list who is a student who is looking for a project, looking at the macroeconomic effects or the calculational effects of socializing certain means of production, I think would be an absolutely worthwhile and wonderful project. Okay, so here's the last question I'm going to entertain this evening from Jay Deneen. Can I expound a bit on what private security will consist of? If protected by private companies, would perhaps those with the greatest source of pay, even a foreign company, shift the direction of how we are defended? What private security would consist of? If we're protected by private companies, would perhaps those with the greatest source of pay? Not exactly sure what's being asked here, but I will expound just a little bit on what private security will consist of. And one of the arguments against it is that the rich are going to be the ones who get all of the security, and so versus government provided military. Okay, so the rich are going to be the ones who get all of the security. When I'm talking about security, I'm talking about security of one's individual person and property. You can hire a security company, and indeed, people spend a lot more money on private security today than we spend on government security. And I'll leave with this. One of the things that I want, and we can pick up more later in the course. In fact, let me make a note of this. We'll talk about military socialism. We'll call it that. So government provision of the means of protection, not just the means of production, but government provision of security. We spend more on private cops than we spend on government cops. And like I said, I want us to avoid what's called the Nirvana fallacy, which is assuming that a perfect world is possible. So I live in Memphis, which is a city with a very, very checkered history of extreme racial injustice. And it's pretty clear that government monopolists were not getting the job done in terms of providing security in a meaningful way and a well-functioning system of private property rights. So the perspective we want to take is comparative institutional, and we want to look and see of an array of imperfect ways to do this, which one causes the least harm ultimately. So with that, next week we're going to pick up with an intense examination of Mises' classic article, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. We'll talk about Joe Salerno's commentary on that. If you have any questions at all, feel free to send them to me at art.cardin@gmail.com, because I blog twice weekly for Mises, and I'm always looking for things to write about. There will be a quiz available soon, and I look forward to talking with you again, same time, same channel.